Take two, side B, Humphrey McQueen. Thelma Hunter.
Thelma Hunter was advocating the establishment of the Women's Studies course. And in the midst of nothing to do with this, like the minutes or something, she got up and said, "Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, but I'm going to have to speak now to the motion about in favour of a Women's Studies course because my Valium's wearing off." But Zabritsky, when we did get round to the discussion time, got up and made this speech about, you know, how the family was going to be destroyed. I mean, it embarrassed his own supporters. I mean, the people who were, you know, again, I mean, it was one of those sort of self-revelatory speeches in which, you know, people think, my God, you know, what is he telling us? So that was happening. I mean, so in some ways it wasn't very difficult to be the only person. You know, I mean, one person could in fact run this this sort of line. Mm-hmm. One occasion, I can't remember what it was now, you asked about my memory, but I mean, on one occasion, they were going to achieve something. There was a man in classics, whose name I can't remember, who was very right-wing, not the head, who was quite liberal and left-wing, but somebody under him, the reader in classics. They were going to move a motion that endorsed something that the dean, the geographer had done, and sort of condemned everything the students had done. And they phrased it in a way that, you know, was sort of, you know, nicely put. And he got up and moved it and made a speech. And before anyone else could do anything, I seconded it and made a speech which just said, yes, I agree with all of this, but it doesn't mean what you say it means. Then they didn't know whether to vote for it or not. I mean, they were totally flummoxed as to what to do with their own motion. As to, you know, if they voted for this, were they in fact voting, inscribing something in the books that they didn't actually want to be, that I was then going to be able to use against them. And it was about reading the minutes and having them confirmed and, you know, all of this sort of stuff. The most spectacular meeting was the day in which, I mean, you might find this in the papers, I have thought at the time that Coombs, particular, was using the student revolt to force changes through the university that he wanted. That they became so frightened that he said to them, I will protect you if you change the following things, you know. So that he used the students as a sort of battering ram, going in one direction, well, the professors all got frightened and he then got them to agree to changes about things that he wanted to make the university. Yeah, I mean, in good sort of ways, but I mean, it was this sort of, you know, arrangement that he could see an opportunity to sort of, you know, to do a Joe in Lie act while the Cultural Revolution was going off in the other direction, you know, that he could get the Chinese bureaucrats to agree to change something. And what he did, and they organised this meeting, which you may have heard about, of all the professors in the school, in the Melville Hall, and they got little desks for them all. And there was a line of them, literally, a whole line right across the thing, and they all lined up there. And the students all came in and faced them. And this was mid-74. And Richard Refshorgi, who had been president of the Students' Association, year before, came and spoke, and the Salazar, well, the Portuguese regime had just been overthrown, and he made this speech comparing the ANU to Portugal being dragged kicking and screaming into the 20th century. But he did have that sort of sense to it, and I looked up and down this row of professors, and I mean, it occurred to me, I'd decided to resign in the middle of 73, so this was a year after I'd already told Mick Williams that I wasn't coming back after the end of 74. And I just looked up and down this line of professors and I thought, if you didn't have a job here, what would you do? I mean, you know, you're just hopeless. You've got yourself into this bizarre situation of, you know, there's sort of 100 of you being lined up by these amateur students. And you don't know what to do. You don't know how to get out of it. You don't want to give in to them, but you don't. You simply don't know what to do. And I thought, oh, well, you know, I'm well out of here, aren't I? The only piece of practical advice, tactical advice I ever gave the students, they were thinking about whether they were planning to occupy the chancellery. And I told them that I thought this was not the thing to do, that no one cared about whether they occupy the fourth floor. They could be up at the top of the fourth floor of the chancellery forever, and it would disrupt nothing. That what they should do was to go and occupy the tea room in the Hayden Allen buildings, and that this would, you know, this would completely disrupt. Like, they really want to destroy people's lives and routines. If they, you know, if the academics couldn't get there for morning and afternoon tea, then, you know, this was. But they looked at me very strangely and thought that I was quite bizarre. You know, that the centre of real life in the university was actually in the tea room, was clearly wrong, and that they had to go and occupy the seat of power, which they then went off and did, and took themselves up into the. Into the
chancellery. Where were you then? Were you engaged in that activity?
No. I mean, they went off and did that. I mean, it didn't seem to me that it would do them any good to have a staff member, you know, with them. And they didn't need it because, I mean, nothing was going to happen to them there. I mean, Coombs wasn't going to send the police in to bash them up. I mean, it wasn't like Latrobe or Flinders or anywhere. I mean, in fact, you know, they sent food up to them, pots of tea and, you know, sort of, you know, I mean, they were sort of nourished and looked after. So they weren't in any danger of being, you know, they didn't need witnesses to protect them in the way in which they might have in some places. And in fact, it would have just, you know, fed the notion that, you know, they were being manipulated by somebody else, if, you know. But I mean, they didn't need any. I mean, Julius Rowe and... I mean, Julius got a lot of his ideas from his father, who was professor of education. I mean, he knew a lot of the results of surveys of how bad teaching was in universities. I mean, how truly appalling it was. And how by then they were offering training courses for staff. And of course the people who took them were the people who didn't need them, as always happens. And those people who were, you know, who simply couldn't function in any form in front of a classroom were standing on their academic freedom about, you know, no one was going to come into my class and, you know, give me pointers on how to be a good lecturer or anything. But Julius, you know, heard from his father all this, or, you know, I mean, in a sense, the anecdotal material about, you know, what you do when you video someone giving a lecture and then show them the video. I mean, all of them. I mean, Julius had a lot of that material that had gone on in the education research, both in New Guinea and in Australia, about teaching methods. And really couldn't see why, you know, every, you know, I mean, I think in a sense the students couldn't see why the staff weren't welcoming this as a way of making life easier for themselves. Mm. I mean, that if there's something you can't do, why don't you get someone to teach you? Clearly they couldn't teach, so why didn't they get someone to help them?
One of the things that's often said is that ANU was far behind the other Australian universities in terms of these protests.
In time.
To what extent was it a copycat sort of activity?
I think it was too late for copycat. I mean, if it was going to be copycat, it should have happened a couple of years earlier. I mean, I think by 73, 74, it really was the students' own concerns about, I mean, having, you know, the experience, not only in history, but largely in history, of getting one kind of treatment, and then getting differently treated in other departments. They just felt that, you know, they should be able to get this generally, and that this should be institutionalised, and that they couldn't see any reason why, if the history department would have them on to departmental meetings and discussions, and, you know, that everything was negotiable. I used to say to them, look, I will give you a choice at the beginning of the year of all the lecture topics you can have during the year. You know, I mean, you know, these are the, you know, there are 52 lectures. You know, I will give you, you know, 80 topics, and you can pick from these which ones you want. But, you know, I mean, this is just a way of controlling you. You know, I mean, I can, you know, I mean, you know, I mean, I can give you choices in a way, which means to say that, you know, that I still don't lose any real control over what I want to do. I mean, in giving you choices, I'm not abandoning standards. I mean, all the things the others used to carry on about as to why they couldn't possibly agree to any of this. And it just seemed to me that if you couldn't manipulate your classes by giving them choices, there was something, I mean, you shouldn't have been teaching in the first place. You know, I mean, one of the first things, I mean, you know, to have that degree of knowledge in your subject, to be able to, you know, I mean, they might say, well, we'd like a lecture on women or something. Well, fine, you do that. But, you know, you'd volunteer those. And, you know, and the others you could lead them to. I mean, they were always happy. I mean, they didn't know. And you could say, look, I really think you should have this one. And they'd say, why? And you'd tell them. They'd say, all right, we'll try that. So, but there was, I mean, it was a bit like the Zabritsky thing of sort of power being taken away from them. And that they might have to, you know, they might have to do something they'd never done before, or, you know, or actually, you know, do some more work for the first, you know, write a new lecture. But see, most of the history people weren't really worried by any of that. I mean, they were accustomed to talking with their students, you know, and on, you know, sort of one-to-one basis or small groups or things. But I think some of the others had, you know, really hadn't just had that kind of daily experience of, you know, of a teaching thing, and they had this notion that the students in some way were going to rampage and burn their files. And I mean, they'd read about all the things that had gone on in, you know, in other universities, you know, in other parts of the world, or, you know, here, you know, things being burned and set fire to, and they had, you know, they'd terrorised themselves with these notions that it was all about to happen here, and they had to. But in that meeting they had with the professors, I mean, they'd actually lost their nerve. I mean, it was sort of, you know, it was Lenin's remark about, you know, the ruling class unable to rule in the old way. I mean, in those few days, they'd actually, you know, they were sort of like a collective headless chook. And that's when I think Coombs, you know, sort of took charge of them and, you know, and said, all right, you know, I will save you from this. With a few other sensible people like Eric and Dick Johnson and Mick Williams, who couldn't see any reason why you couldn't have the Putney debates. I think perfectly reasonable way to behave.
Just in passing, had you been aware of Coombs' presence around the place before this time? Had you been aware that he was playing a significant role in university affairs? Which, of course, was rather odd for a chancellor to do.
I suppose I did, because I knew... I mean, I'd been alerted to this by Bruce McFarlane as to the kind of roles that Coombs and Crawford had played, in the kind of way in which Crawford had tried to put a bomb under the Institute in the 60s by bringing in people like Jack Kelly and things to try and make it into a place where, you know, where unconventional things could happen as well, and always trying to sort of get, you know, sort of shake them and to get changes happen. I knew from Dorothy Green that Coombs had bartered with the English department over, would give them an extra lecturing position if they would run a full-time course in Australian literature. So I did know that you know, that certain ideological levels about the kinds of things he thought should be happening.
I hadn't heard that.
That he was operating in these kinds of, because they were going to close it down at one stage again, and he'd said, no, I mean, you know, must have an Australian literature unit at the ANU. It just, you know, can't not be done. So I probably had a bit of that sense as to the kinds of things that he was trying to, you know, from the background. But yes, I mean, certainly he was more like a kind of academic, ideological vice chancellor than a chancellor, as you say. I mean, it was much more. I mean, he had seemed that he had more policy directions and ideas. I suppose that had really come from when he and Crawford were able to run it between them. I mean, that you know, the days in which, I mean, they carried forward their old public service links and their notions as to what the aim, oh, probably from 1944 when the place was set up, and their notion of the kind of service they thought it was going to provide to the welfare state.
And part of this was happening, of course, when there was a vacuum in the Vice Chancellor's position while Williams was there. Did you have anything to do with Williams at all?
No. I mean, the only thing I know, I think, I don't know who told me, perhaps Pat White, about the story as to how they got him. That they sent the telegram to the wrong person. But that actually was supposed to be to Bruce Williams.
No, I don't think I believe that story. I have heard it, but it's a nice one.
But it's certainly, I mean, it's certainly the you know, the kind of, you know, the as close to a rational explanation as to why he'd been appointed as anyone had come up with.
During your time at the university, would you have seen your affiliation essentially a departmental one rather than to the faculty or to the university as a whole?
Yes. I didn't go to faculty meetings for, you know, very much before it became sort of, you know, advantageous to the students to have somebody there to play ducks and drakes with the sort of rules for them and to watch, to watch them. And that would have only been in 74, I think. It might have been late 73. I just found going to meetings boring. It was the last thing I ever wanted to do. And the university, I suppose, really didn't have any existence as a university. I can't think of how you would have. I mean, I used to eat in the students' union and the refectory, but there was not much else that you could sort of, I could now think to identify as the university.
Well, I've lately been reading a paper by the maligned Seth Gibb, who said that a university ceases to be a university when the chemists no longer talk to the historians or the people studying Hindi or whatever. And this is when they're talking about a notional size of a university being around about 4,000 students in all, graduates and undergraduates.
Yeah.
And of course, ANU had not long passed that number, which was certainly above 4,000 at that stage.
There was a bit of college life, and because some of the students were in college, you'd sometimes get invited to do something at one of the colleges, perhaps talk or attend a dinner or something, and they would sort of offer a bit of return hospitality in a kind of way, but very little of that even.
There was no real sense of an academic community then beyond the department?
Well, not for me, but I mean, I was a senior tutor. I mean, I wasn't, you know, I mean, I was hardly in a position to be part of this. I mean, Eric told me a lovely story once about how all his life in academia he tried to get to somewhere where a decision was being made, and he thought finally when he got to being dean of the faculty he would actually be somewhere in a room one day when a decision was made, but he said they never were. They're always still being made in some other room.
What about relations with the Institute?
But it was interesting when you were remarking on this coming down, and I was thinking, well, see, I arrived not really understanding that it wasn't all the same place. I mean, I know that you know, seems quite naive of anyone to think, and it took me a long time, and in fact, I don't know that I ever really accepted that it wasn't all the same place, because, I mean, I used to use the Menzies Library when I wanted it, and I'd pop up and see people in the Institute. And I got to understand that there was all this history of rivalry, and you know, you had two libraries for all these reasons, and you know, and that there was resentments on both sides. But I just thought of it as another part of a sort of branch of the ANU. I suppose it was partly because it didn't strike me that it was actually functioning as a higher research institute. I mean, the notion, whatever its own thought of itself as being, you know, this superior body. I mean, it was simply a fact that there were more postgraduate students in the school than there were in the history department in the institute. And then, you know, it didn't register with me that if you were doing a PhD, you went to the institute. Rather, because I mean, we had 20 students doing PhDs full time in the department, and they had four up in the institute. I mean, it just, I knew some of the students up there, like Graham Osborne and people, but their feelings about, Graham's, telling me one day that he told Jack Lanois that he was going to write a piece of, in his thesis on Tom Mann, he was going to talk about, the kind of problems of somebody with advanced ideas coming to a society like Victoria and trying to get them to change them, and how he had to change himself and what this meant. And Lado saying to him, he said, "Mr. Osborne, that's all very interesting, but while you're a student in my department, you'll confine yourself to presenting facts which no one has previously discovered." So, I mean, with these sort of anecdotes, I mean, it never occurred to me that there was this, this thing actually existed, that it... I did get to realise, of course, that increasingly as I was there, that there were a lot of people up there who were taking their money and not doing any work. I mean, I suppose the most obvious example to me, because I'd known him at Queensland, was Don Rawson. And he'd published a book in Queensland when I was there, and hadn't. I don't think he's published a book since. So it became clear that that if this was the fountain house of great wisdom and thick books, then there were plenty of people up there who weren't pulling their weight. And I'd never been able to take Kaminka seriously. But it wasn't... See, having decided... having taken 18 months or so to decide I was staying, and then 18 months before I left to decide that I was going... I wasn't actually there for very long.
No.
And I didn't see myself... I mean, having arrived and thinking, well, I might be going at the end of this year and the end of next year. And then after, sort of 2 years, I suppose, of knowing I was going to be there, and then deciding that I was going, I wasn't positioning my imagination and my future in terms of the nature of the university. I mean, I wasn't then... I suppose the next thing would have been to try to get a permanent position there, as a lecturer or something. But instead of deciding that, I decided on my birthday in 1973 to leave. And I was sitting in the tea room one afternoon as I turned 31 and looked up the tea room and saw somebody who was 32 and somebody else who was 33 and somebody all the way up to 65. And I thought, I'm not going to stay here. This is too genteel. This is too nice. As you end up, this is the short road to brain death. You've got to get out. But no one was believing I was going. I mean, the other thing about it was, once you got into the convalescent home, it was a bit like the Magic Mountain. I mean, you were going to stay forever. So when I told Mick that I was leaving, I thought I should give him plenty of warning so they could, find someone to take my place. They just thought, oh, yes, this is just one of the signs of convalescence. People are always going to leave, but nobody ever does. And it took great effort to really convince them that I wasn't coming back.
Did you have in mind what you were leaving to?
Well, I was leaving to write what I was going to do. I mean, Judy's view was that, I mean, this was her experience of the place as well. I mean, she said, she said, well, look, I'm not going to stay married to somebody who spends their life at dinner parties saying that if only they had taken the time, they too could have written a great book. He said, if I've got to support you for a couple of years, I'll do it. And if you can't write a great book, then shut up about it.
And you never regret that decision?
No.
And that's not specifically about ANU, but about universities generally, presumably.
Well, yeah. I mean, I enjoy popping back in and meeting students and, teaching like the 2 years in Japan or 3 months I did in Curtin in 87 or a month in Griffith a couple of years back. I mean, they're enjoyable things to do. But that's because I don't have to be part of the academic system. I don't have to go to meetings. I don't have to sit on committees and deal with all of that. I can just do the nice bit, which is to meet the students and give them some lectures and and swan out again.
You were associated again formally with the university, of course. It must have been in, what, 77, 78, as a visiting fellow at HRC.
That was later. That was 84.
Beg your pardon.
Yeah, true. I'm never quite sure to this day how that happened. I mean, I got a letter saying, would you like it to happen? I assumed, at the time that I was actually going to get, you know, a salary for 3 months. But of course, because normally they get people there who have salaries, they give them a stipend to make up the difference. When we found that out, I complained a bit, and so they ran around and made it the biggest stipend that they said they could, which was still, for me, a real income. I mean, it was more than I was earning, this sort of living away from home allowance that they were providing for whatever that 3 months, I suppose, it would have been, wouldn't it?
I think it was.
Yeah. And that was part of their landscape painting thing. That again was very pleasant. I gave a couple of seminars, which is all one is apparently required to do under these circumstances. Attended a couple of conferences. Lots of afternoon teas. Endless afternoon teas. Welcoming or farewelling people. That was very... didn't actually alter my life in any real way. I stayed at home and wrote in the mornings and went in there in the afternoon and then went to the library there instead of coming here. And they gave me, $2,000 or $3,000, which was agreeable. But it was less than I got when I went down to the Chameleon Arts Centre a couple of months later for 4 months to be writer-in-residence down there. But, that's because I wasn't an academic somewhere else that they were bringing in. I don't think they had any system for coping with people who were unsalaried on arrival.
You don't give a very charitable view of the benefits of an academic community. For the creative writer.
Well, the 5 years I spent there was certainly a great benefit to me. I learned, I suppose, that I could lecture, and having done that, I didn't see any reason why I should go on doing the same thing for the rest of my life. But it means now that I do know. I can get up and show off and lecture for 50 minutes without a note, which I wouldn't have been able to do if I hadn't, put in that hard slog. I must say, I didn't do that in Japan because I had to go so slowly. There's no way that I could, it was quite a different structure of lecturing there.
So you recommend the Don Baker principle only for a certain time?
Apprenticeship. Except now, of course, when I do lecture without a note, it's because I'm really... I've actually written it out in some other way.
Yes.
It is as deeply researched and structured. And there are occasional lectures. If you had to give 52 to a group of first years, I do agree with Elton that one function of the university lecturer is to stimulate, not to inform. So that, the sense of giving a lecture which is wild is part of the university lecture. So that it's not quite necessary to write everything down and put it on the blackboard and things. There is that other function of the lecture as well, which is to sort of make them think in a way which they haven't thought before. Mm. And that might be a kind of performance every now and again, as well as the other kind. And certainly the 5 years there, because of the light teaching, considered to be a light teaching load, but it wasn't then. 7 hours contact, 7 or 9 hours it became, was considered quite a normal, particularly in the last 3 years when I was giving the two lectures and conducting, six 6 hours seminars a week. It was considered to be, you know, a heavy teaching load in those days. But I had really no administrative responsibilities, of course, the other advantage of being a senior tutor. And it let me, well, I mean, it compelled me to do lots of research and lots of thinking, because in supervising all those research essays, I was actually learning an enormous amount, you know, people doing things about the Methodist Church and things that I never would have, you know, devoted a fraction of my brain to. So that was all, you know, that was all very helpful. And some of it is still there. I mean, some of it is still part of the intellectual brickwork that I can stand on or borrow a brick from to put it somewhere else. That is still there. And certainly if I hadn't had it, I don't think I could have got from school teaching to where I then got to. I don't think that, I mean, I think, not that I knew this at the time, of course, and, you know, and, but I think that now it's, it was, you know, it was an absolutely, I mean, the move to Canberra at that time was an essential step in all of that, and I certainly don't regret any of it. And I had a beaut time the 5 years I was at the ANU.
That's a very helpful and positive note on which to end.